A very good evening to all of you, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Satish. I'm a member of Ananda Sangha Mumbai. In Mumbai, Ananda Sangha, we have a flourishing center where we have group meditations every month. We have special Kriyaban meditations, and we have got regular classes periodically in meditation, Raja Yoga, and preparation for Kriya Yoga. And it is our plan very soon to have these classes in Marathi and Hindi also. Marathi madhe ani Hindi madhe suddha he varga lokarach chalu karnyacha prayatna madhe ami ahot ani te lokarach chalu hotil. It is my pleasure and privilege to welcome you this evening to this function on the occasion of the release of the book Paramahansa Yogananda, a biography by Swami Kriyananda, a direct disciple of Paramahansa Yogananda and the founder of Ananda Sangha. Ananda Sangha is a spiritual non-profit organization started by Swami Kriyanandaji with the aim of spreading his guru's teachings the world over, and in particular, to give shape to his guru's ideals of the world brotherhood colonies, where spiritually minded people live together, work together, and meditate together. The teachings of Paramahansa Yogananda are the same teachings of Sanatana Dharma, which Paramahansa Yogananda took to the West, and now a Western yogi, Swami Kriyanandaji, is bringing those teachings back to India, to the land from where it all began. So friends, I now ask Mr. Aditya to come on the stage. Brahmachari Aditya, please. He will be the master of ceremonies for this evening. Aditya. Where is Aditya? Okay. The program then begins with an invocation to the Lord, as all the programs in India begin. And before that is the lighting of the lamp by the chief guest. I call upon Dr. D.R. Sikarthikeyan, Jyotish and Devi, the spiritual directors of Ananda Worldwide, Siddharam Dasji and Nirmala, to light the lamp.
Well, thank you, Satish ji, and my apologies for being missing for a while. Good evening, all of you.
This evening and every sacred ceremony, we begin by invoking the blessings, the grace, the power of our gurus. So we will do so this evening as well.
Gurur Brahma, Gurur Vishnu, Gurur Deva Maheshwara, Gurur Sakshat Parabrahma, Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Brahmanandam paramasukhadam kevalam jnanamurtim dandvatitam gaganasadrisham tattvamasyadilaksham ekam nityam bhimalamachalam sarvadeshakshivutam bhavatitam Trigunarahitam Sadgurum Tvam Namami.
Thank you, Dharamdas Ji. And a very warm welcome and thanks to all of you for showing in such wonderful numbers. It simply speaks about the enthusiasm this city still has for a spiritual master. Swami Kriyananda will be before us very soon. And my name is Brahmachari Aditya. I come from Pune. I'm part of Ananda Sangha. And let me speak a little bit about who we are, what we do, and when did we start on this path. Speaking of the path, something very interesting which often comes to my mind is what Paramahansa Yogananda once said to a devotee. He said, "There's no one on this planet who is not on the spiritual path." It's such a sweet encouragement, such a sweet assurance. We may sometimes feel, people often ask us, you know, do you come to Mumbai? That's one question they have. They say, once I was told by a spiritual order, our monks do not go to Mumbai. It's too materialistic for them. And I said, yes, you know, we go there, but we come back. And there was this distinction between the material world and the spiritual world. And that was something Swami Sri Yukteswar too was struggling when he was roaming in the Kumbh Mela looking for spiritual masters. And Babaji read his mind and he said, "I will send you a devotee whose job it will be to unite the East and the West." And Yoganandaji was that devotee. Swami Kriyananda now at the age of 85 has come back to India. This was in 2003 when he stepped into India again. He had been here many times before. But this time when he came with the intention of starting a world brotherhood community, a Kriya Yoga community of its first kind in this country. Not only towards Yogananda's last years, Swamiji said he heard from other devotees that many times, a small request over here, it'll be nice if we can all switch off our mobile phones. But Swamiji said, Yoganandaji repeatedly said that we need world brotherhood communities, places where like-minded people can get together, stay together, have places of job, worship, and even farming, he suggested, in one place. And Swamiji took this step in 1969 when Ananda Village was started in America. Today it is sprawling over 1,100 acres. More than 350 residents stay there permanently. And Ananda has spread not just from that one community. It's not just that one community. It has now 8 communities. And in India, we are established in many places, but our community is thriving and growing now outside Pune. We are situated over there. All of you must have got the brochures in which you can get all the information about our events over there and what we have been doing. We are 3 years old, shall I say, in Pune, slightly over three years old. So Mumbai is so close. It's like a brother or sister city, whatever you wish to call it. I invite you all to come over there and see for yourself the sweet things that are taking shape. I would also like to take you through the events that are going to happen this evening. There was a prayer by Dharamdas Ji. By the way, I let a brief introduction. Dharamdas and Nirmala Ji, who were just here, they are the spiritual directors of Ananda India. And we have with us Jyotish and Devi Ji from America, who are the spiritual directors of Ananda Worldwide. They have all been blessed to be with Swamiji for many decades now. And after I stop talking in a while, we will have our Ananda choir come over here. We will have our chief guest, Dr. Karthikeyan Ji, who was the former director of CBI, come over. He will give a brief talk about Swamiji, about Ananda. And it's a very blessed occasion. I'm again and again thrilled to see so many people. This is the release of the biography. We will also be speaking towards the end of this program. After Swami Kriyananda has spoken, Swamiji will speak for a while. He will release the book. And after that, we will be sharing with you all the trailer of the book, Yogananda. So that book is very soon going to be made into a major motion picture. with collaboration from Hollywood and now Bollywood, shall I say, because we are in Mumbai. So devotees from West and East are uniting their energies to bring this movie on Yogananda's life alive. So we will be showing a trailer about that. And not to forget, as you all leave, we have a sweet recording of Swamiji's songs for you. And he wants to gift that to everyone along with the slideshow which is there in a CD as a souvenir which all of you can carry back home. So do not forget to take that. And I hope all of you will be here till the end of the event when we will be blessed to do that and share that gift with you. So right now I would like to invite Karthikeyanji to please come on stage and share a few words with us. Karthikeyanji is not just a long-term friend of Ananda. He takes pride in calling himself the patron of Ananda, and that's a sweet gesture on his behalf. Thank you very much for coming this evening.
Namaskar. Good evening to all of you, ladies and gentlemen. As Aditya just said, it's such a heartwarming experience to see this beautiful hall filled up with seekers of spirituality in the commercial capital of India. Ultimately, with all the money and power, people feel that it's not going to give them the satisfaction or peace of mind or harmony. It is only the spiritual path that will give contentment, happiness. After all, every being, not only human beings, they seek peace and happiness in different paths. Ultimately, the great masters of all traditions of all times have found that peace, contentment, and happiness can come only by following a spiritual path. Here we are talking about a great disciple of a greater master. The devotion of such a intensity is very rarely seen anywhere in the world. That's quality I admire most in Swami Kriyananda. And we all know about autobiography of a yogi, the most celebrated autobiography of any spiritual master, Paramahamsa Yogananda, I think translated into most of the languages in the world. Swami Kriyananda, for the very few who may not have known about Ananda Sangha and Swamiji, was Donald Walters at the young age of 22. He happened to look at the book, Autobiography of Yogi, by chance, got attracted by what appeared on the cover of the book, picked up the book, and sat for 3 or 4 days at a stretch, completed the book, and took the next available bus, went to the other coast, had darshan of Paramahamsa Yogananda, and asked him, Swamiji, please accept me as your disciple. That was instantaneous transformation that took place by just reading the book. And then he became one of the favorite disciples of Paramahamsa Yogananda, who named him Kriyananda and gave him the task of spreading Kriya Yoga. In fact, it is said, Swamiji, Paramahamsa Yogananda told him, your life will be one of intense activity and meditation. Kriyananda means bliss through action and through the practice of the meditative science of Kriya Yoga. So his life of service and meditation has borne great fruit, not only in America, in many parts of the world. Trained by the great Indian master to spread the life-transforming teachings of Kriya Yoga around the world, Swamiji has written over 140 books, but I think maybe more now. He keeps on writing, keeps on recording TV interviews, 10 episodes, 15 episodes at a stretch, even though he is not in the best of physical health. But his amazing memory and expression, any number of books, He's also a singer par excellence. I think we'll have the privilege of listening to Swamiji singing also today, apart from the... In fact, in Ananda Sangha, everybody is a singer. Everyone is a singer. You ask anyone, they will sing. And collectively, they make a wonderful impact on everybody. And Swamiji is also a photographer of great repute. Of course, one of the world's foremost experts on meditation, yoga, and spiritual practice. About Ananda Sangha, you have just heard from the earlier speakers, a worldwide organization committed to the dissemination of Paramahamsa Yogananda's teachings. He's also said that 1968 he founded the first of the Ananda communities worldwide. They provide a supporting environment of simple living and high thinking. I have had the privilege of being with the community in America and Italy, Assisi. They are wonderful people. You find all of them always full of smile, contentment, joy. They're soft. You can see their face. There's total happiness, and they spread joy also when you go and talk to them, meet them. And Swamiji said that having fulfilled the master's dream or idea of establishing spiritual brotherhood communities in some other parts of the world, he thought it should be done in the birthplace of his master. So he came down here, and as it was mentioned by Aditya, a beautiful Ananda community center has come up on the hills near Pune. And I have seen Nevada and other places where Swamiji lives in one of the most beautiful places. But he was prepared to leave it and come back. Living in Gurgaon is not an easy thing for a person who lived in Ananda village in Nevada. But he came back because of his commitment to do something in the land of birth of his great master. His entire life has been devoted to teaching and writing, helping others to experience the joy and living presence of the God within. He has personally lectured on 4 continents in 5 languages over the course of the last 64 years. His television programs, audio and video recordings of his talks and music, and his nearly 150 books in 28 languages are available in nearly 100 countries. It has touched the lives of millions of people. Swamiji has taken the ancient teachings of Raja Yoga and made them intensely practical and immediately useful for people in every walk of life on a daily basis. His books and teachings cover nearly every field of human activity endeavor, including spiritualizing business life, leadership, education, arts, community life, and science. He has also written extensive commentaries on the Bible and the Bhagavad Gita. The book was released by Chief Minister of Delhi, Sheila Dixit, a couple of years back in Delhi. Swamiji believes, I quote, "Men need now to become God-centered from within, and from that center to see God everywhere in everything." Swamiji's books and poems are intended to help us individuals to expand our awareness and deepen our inner experience of God. He has composed over 400 pieces of music, maybe more now, last few months, I know he must have added some more, for voice and instrumentals. He describes them as coming through him from a higher source rather than being created by him. He is so humble. Whatever he writes, he says, is the thoughts of his master. He is only an instrument through whom it's expressed. He feels music can help to uplift consciousness, both in the listener and in the performers. Many of his students are also musicians, as I mentioned to you. He has developed a method of educating children that teaches skills in maturity and character to prepare children for success in life. Children learn emotional self-mastery, conflict resolution, and compassion, among many other skills. Swamiji has been honored. His services have been recognized all over the world. Some of them are made a member of the Club of Budapest International. Other members include Mikhail Gorbachev, Dalai Lama, Archbishop Desmond Tutu. He is the recipient of 2004 International Award for Goodness by International Committee of Third Millennium. The previous recipients of the award include the Dalai Lama. Swami speaks several languages, as I told you earlier, including Italian, French, Spanish, German, Hindi, Bengali, Romanian, Indonesian, and of course English. He has given lectures in English, Italian, French, German, and Spanish. He has also lectured in Hindi and Bengali. He is a man of many talents and specialized skills. Today, Swamiji's latest book is being released, the biography of Paramahamsa Yogananda. This book by his disciple Swami Kriyananda is born of first-hand knowledge. It contains solid facts. Never before has the life of the great master been described so beautifully. Swamiji offers illuminating insights into his master's experiences, his life work, and teachings. He quotes his master, "It is India's destiny to be the guru of this planet. In that country alone have the ancient truths been preserved. It will be good for representatives of other nations to heed India's ancient message, for therein lies our planet's ultimate salvation." Going by the headlines of newspapers and television, you may find it hard to believe, but that's the reality. It's an aberration what we are going through. I'm sure that things will only get better. It can't become worse than what it is today. That is why the need for masters like Swami Kriyananda and others to come and bring back to our knowledge, remember our ancient glory, and get over this mess we have created for ourselves today. The safest way to remain on this straight and narrow path is to serve others, never thinking of what you get from them. This is what he quotes his master. Swami Yogananda never wanted to concentrate on one aspect of society alone. His mission was to show all mankind how to prepare for a higher level of consciousness by living together cooperatively, not competitively, by making business methods a process of sharing, not of taking, by treating life itself as an opportunity to find commonality with others and not considering anyone in an outsider one's sympathies. An important part of the master's mission on earth was to show the underlying unity between the teachings of Jesus Christ and of Krishna, and also the deeper teachings between both those religions. What I admire in Ananda Sangha and the teachings of the great master and his disciples about the unity of all the religions, about integrity of the humanity. You can follow your own path, but you must also learn to respect other ways of living, other ways of worship. Ultimately, all paths lead to the same goal, that is realizing the divinity inherent in each of the human beings, whether you may call it a Hindu or a Christian or a Muslim or a Jew. We are so grateful to Swamiji. In spite of his very good physical health, he has made it to be here. And I believe in the last few days also, even in Ananda village in Pune, he has been continuously recording TV interviews and all that. So we are grateful to Swamiji. I have been telling Swamiji, you are destined to be here for a long, long time to come, at least for 100 years, to serve India and the whole of humanity. And on behalf of all of you, I extend my gratitude to Swamiji, seek his blessings. And you are fortunate, those who are here are fortunate to listen to his words of wisdom and also his divine music. Thank you. Namaskar.
Thank you very much, Karthikeyanji. Ladies and gentlemen, now please join me in welcoming Swami Kriyananda. Please take your seats. I'd like to now invite the Ananda Choir. We'll be singing two songs for all of you.
sing two songs for you written by Swami Kriyanandaji. The first of these is called Life is a Dream.
Life is a dream, time like a stream, carries our burdens away. Never despair, joy's everywhere, love can be friend you today. Free from all care, like birds on the air, soar above griefs and worries, seek joy and be gay. Often on earth, things of great worth, worldly ambitions defy. Sometimes a friend helps us ascend up from life's cares to the sky. Love is a star, though shining afar, it can guide us and help us store light to draw nigh. Life is a
Thank you very much, all choir members, and thank you for your sweet applause and reception. I would like to now invite Sangeeta Ji, who is the Kriyaban with us, who is also the head of our publication department, and I request Swamiji now to release this book by giving his blessings. I'd also like to now invite...
Okay, and give it back to you, right? Okay. So we have people coming up.
I'd like to invite Karthikeyan Ji now. Please come and receive a book from Swamiji. Also, our spiritual directors of Ananda Worldwide, Jyotish and Devi.
Sri Karthikeyan wrote the introduction to this book. Thank you. Thank you.
Casey, you could also come, please. Mr. and Mrs. Narinder Nair. And Mrs. Narinder Nair, Ashish Ji.
Thank you, Casey. Flowers too.
Swami Anubhavananda Ji from Chinmay Mission. I request you to please come and receive a copy from Swami Ji. And Mr. Rao, who is also a dear devotee, I request him to come up. I also request our IBD distributors to please come up and receive a copy from Swamiji. So much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Swamiji.
Is there anybody else? This is for you. There's a story about four Italian women, and they were boasting about their sons. One said, "My son is a priest, and everybody who addresses him calls him Your Reverence." The second one said, "Well, my son is a cardinal. Everybody who addresses him says Your Grace." And the third one said, "Well, my son is the Pope, and all of everybody calls him Your Holiness." And the fourth woman was quite out of it, and she didn't know what to say. And she said, "My son is very tall and very big, and every time anybody sees him, they say, 'Oh, my God.'" Well, self-importance is very common among spiritual people, among religious teachers. They tend to be pompous. And somehow they think that because they're talking about God, they have to be Him. I don't know. But anyway, piety is usually judged, or often judged, I should say, in terms of severity and primness and all sorts of unattractive words. One beautiful thing about my guru, I lived with him for nearly 4 years, and I had a chance to be very close to him. And I have to say that, first of all, every time I looked into his eyes, I saw no ego there at all. It was as if, I remember one time I was sitting at his feet. He was working on his commentaries on the Bhagavad Gita. And I was sitting there just thinking, what a blessing it was to be his disciple. And then he asked me to help him get to his feet, and he stood up and he looked at me just very close. He said, just the bulge of the ocean. He only saw himself as an expression of God. He used to say to us, I am not the guru, God is the guru. I think a true guru is one who understands that God is the teacher. He is not anything himself. He's only a channel. And I am only a channel for Yogananda. In myself, I have no importance. But the beautiful thing is I learned these things from him. He had a wonderful sense of humor. I remember he was telling us one time about how he himself was introduced to the lecture. Thousands of people had come to hear him. And there was Roman Ostoya, who was from Poland, and something of a teacher himself, and he took over. He was introducing him, and he went on and on and on, and he kept breaking in and saying, no, I will tell you a most wonderful thing. And then he'd go on talking, and people finally began getting up and walking out. He kept on talking, and now I will tell you a most wonderful thing, and then he'd go on and on. Finally, at the end of it, half the people had left already. Finally, he said, and now I will tell you a most wonderful thing. Keep the corners of the mouth. Oop! And my guru, I called him master. He just laughed so hard over this. He didn't worry about his being stood up by so many people who just finally lost patience and left. It was too delightful for him. I loved his even-mindedness. Nothing could faze him. No matter what happened, he was always even-minded. He was very kind. He was concerned for everybody. I never saw him being unkind. He was never condescending. You'd think such a great master would be condescending to people. He was not. He talked just as if he was even with them. And no condescension, no put on, no display, nothing at all. Just himself. There's a wonderful story, because he had this feeling of love for everybody in the world, in the universe. But one time he was driving down the streets in Los Angeles, and Debbie Mukherjee from Calcutta was with him, so he told me the story. And suddenly Yogananda said, stop the car. So they stopped the car, and he walked back a few shops to another place nearby. And it was a little tiny junk shop, nothing particularly important in it. And Yogananda went and bought a few junky items. And Debbie thought, well, what on earth is he going to do with those things? And he came to the front, to the desk there, and when he came up with all those things, the woman looked quite excited. And when he paid her, she burst into tears. She said, I badly needed exactly this sum of money. And closing time was near, and I had lost hope of getting it. She said, God himself must have sent you. And Yogananda didn't say anything about it afterwards. He didn't use the things that he had bought. But his concern for this complete stranger, he had picked up on her need. And that to him was all that mattered. He knew our thoughts. I remember one time I was invited to give a demonstration of the yoga posture. Seeing me stumbling here this evening, you probably don't know it, but I was pretty good at the yoga postures at one time. And afterwards, I'm not a Jew, but it was a bar mitzvah. And afterwards, there's Jewish psychiatrists in Beverly Hills. They tend to be very materialistic. And he was challing me about my beliefs, and I was talking to him, trying to persuade him and the truth of them, the validity of my beliefs. And I actually told him about a few miracles that I'd seen with my own eyes. And I could see him thinking, Wednesday at 11, I have space for this patient. And a couple of days later, I was with Yogananda, and he said, oh, by the way, when you're talking with atheistic people, materialist people, don't talk about miracles. I said, you knew. He said, I know every thought you think. I was amazed at that. But he showed it again and again, not just my thoughts, but the thoughts of all his disciples. There was a one time, I'll just tell another silly story on myself along that line. I was talking to somebody in the church in Hollywood, and I was the minister there, and I told him I would be giving the class on Thursday night, and he said, oh, I'll be sure to be there. Well, I knew that he was going to be there anyway, and I didn't like the flattery. So I tried to defuse the flattery, and I said, in that case, would you please check people's pockets for garbage? And it was not a very dignified thing to say, but anyway, when I was with Master a few days later, he said, oh, by the way, when you're with people in the congregation, don't talk about garbage. It's not dignified. He knew I could do nothing with him. One time, one of the ministers in Phoenix, James Culler, he was coming back to Encinitas, and he was driving from Phoenix, Arizona, to Encinitas, California, a drive of quite a few hours. And it was late at night, and the highway was, all the restaurants were closed, and James was getting more and more hungry. And finally he came to a restaurant, but all they had was hamburger. So he thought, well, he won't know. So he had a couple of hamburgers. And when he was talking to Master in Encinitas later on, Master, after the talk and everything, he said, in other words, he didn't scold him for anything, but he just said at the end of it, by the way, James, when you're out late on this highway, late at night, and you've come to a place that has only hamburgers, better not eat anything. Of course, we're all vegetarians there. His wisdom was really amazing. I know he told me that when he wrote his interpretation of the Bhagavad Gita, based on my memories of him, I wrote that commentaries of the Bhagavad Gita, but it's his, it's not mine. And it was an amazing experience in itself, but I remember him telling me, he said, now I understand why my guru never wanted me to read other people's commentaries. He said, when I sat down to write this, I tuned into Veda Vyasa, and I said, you please write this through me. And everything he wrote through me. When I was with Yogananda and he was writing these interpretations, he just looked at the point between the eyebrows and began speaking. This was a marvelous example of his wisdom. It came from God. It was not intellectual wisdom. One of the charms of the autobiography of a yogi is his wonderful good humor. And I told you a little bit about his humor before. There was another case. He visited a Christian fundamentalist. And the fundamentalist suddenly, they were talking about spiritual matters, and the fundamentalist said, we're all sinners, we'll all go to hell. You know, that's a fundamentalist teaching, ridiculous. And Yogananda thought, well, let me not argue with him. He didn't say anything for a while. And he said, by the way, you have a son, don't you? Oh my God, have I ever got a son? He gives you a lot of trouble, doesn't he? Oh, you should see the trouble. He comes home drunk every night. He never thinks about anything but pleasure. Yogananda said, well, I have a cure for you. Man said, oh, if you can do anything else, I'll be so grateful to you. So Yogananda said, well, let me first ask you a question. Do you have an oven? Yes. What are you talking about, an oven? I have an oven. Does it have a large door? Yes. Well, what are you getting at? No, just asking you, does it have a large door? Yes, it has a large door. All right, now I tell you what you do. When your son comes home at night, have the oven nice and hot now. When the son comes home, hit him harder than the head, stuff in the oven, burn it up. Blasphemer, how dare you speak like that? And he was very upset. Yogananda said, look, here you're a human father, and you don't want to kill your own son and put him in hell, put him in an oven to burn him up. How can you think God, who is your heavenly father, would want to burn you for a little mistake like that? And the man was completely changed by then. And he said, I understand, that's a false teaching. But Yogananda went to the West to teach people true Christianity, not this hellfire and damnation nonsense. Religions that teach that just don't understand. Yes, there's a hell, but the destiny and all true religions in the universe must have the same teaching. There is one religion anywhere, everywhere. It is called Sanatana Dharma. In Sanskrit, we call it that. On the most distant planet in the most distant galaxy, it has to be the same religion, because it's not a matter of belief. Everything has come from God. Everything must merge back into God. And no religion that doesn't teach that is a true religion. There are false sects within religions, but the true religion is that you are a part of God's dream. You are a part of Him. And everything that you have finally to overcome your ego, you have finally to understand that He dreamed you into existence. And then you must merge back into Him. Yogananda had a lot of power. One time, but there were many times, one time there was he lectured. When he lectured, he had great force. This is not his actual words, but it's the mood of his teaching, and I heard him talk like this. He was invited to be a guest at a banquet in high society in New York. And when he was asked to speak, he said, "Well, I'd rather not." And they said, "Oh, you must speak." And he said, "Fine." He said, "Well, you won't like what I have to say." But they insisted, so he did. And he said, "You call yourselves high society. What makes you that? High ought to imply a heightened sense of consciousness. Is your consciousness high? Is it in any way uplifted? At least half of you are drunk. Your interests in life are shallow. If by high you mean that your ponds are so shallow that the bottom of them is almost at the surface, there I agree with you. From your conversation this evening, however, I have the impression that all any of you think about is money, profit, flattery, and chasing after one another's wives. Being in high society ought to give you a sense of responsibility to those below you in the social scale. You should set them an example. You might act nobly and stoop down to help them. Instead, what do? If you stoop at all, it is to empty their pockets of any pittance they may still have left. Shame on all of you. I hoped in coming here this evening at least to find people of culture. Instead, I find what I find is so many pigs at a trough, swilling, munching, and gulping as though life offered nothing higher to that supposedly noble creature, man, than whitewash for his sepulcher. No wonder Jesus Christ said, 'Let the dead bury their dead.'" He could be fierce, no question about it. But I remember one time when he was giving a lecture at a garden party in Beverly Hills. And, you know, after a garden party, there were about 800 people there. Hollywood movie stars, directors, all sorts of people of importance in Hollywood and in Beverly Hills. And usually if you're the guest of honor, you thank your hostess and you thank your guests and you can make a few comments and a few philosophical expressions because he was considered a saint. And then you thank everybody and that's it. Well, I tell you, in my life, I have never heard such a powerful talk in my life. He didn't waste any time thanking anybody. He said, "This day marks the beginning of a new era. My words, I am sowing my words in the ether, and my words shall not die. Thousands of youths must go north, south, east, and west to spread the idea of communities." In all those 800 people, I was the only person who heard him. The others heard his words, I heard his spirit, and I vowed that I would fulfill what he was saying. And in my life, I have been able to build 8 communities in Nevada City, California, Sacramento, California, Palo Alto, California, Portland, Oregon, Seattle, Washington, Assisi, Italy, Los Angeles, Gurgaon, and Pune. And about 1,000 people live there. So if one person he could reach, fine. Well, one time he was in Chicago. It was this during the Depression years, and there was a considerable amount of crime in Chicago at that time. And Yogananda decided he wanted to go and sit down in Lakeside Park after dark. And a policeman outside said, don't go in there now. None of us dare go in there. And Yogananda said, never mind, God is with me. So he went and he sat on a bench to enjoy the moonrise. And after a few minutes, this big thug came up to him and said, give me a dime. I gave him a dime. Dime means 10 cents. Give me a quarter, that means 25 cents. Give me 50 cents. So he gave it to him. Finally he said, give me a dollar. Master said, he said, just figured this could go on forever. So he suddenly leapt to his feet. He said, get out! And the man just started trembling all over. He said, I don't want your money, I don't want your money. He dropped it and ran for his life. And Master sat down and enjoyed the moonrise. And when he came out of the park, the policeman said, what did you say to that man? We know him for a very dangerous character. Master said, oh, we had little understanding. The first disciples came to him in his early years. They didn't know what his greatness was because he wanted everybody to feel that what I have done, you can do. And so he didn't speak about his inner state. And they looked upon him as a great man, but they didn't see him as we saw him who came later in life. I remember Dr. Lewis. He was his first Kriya Yoga disciple in America. And they were both young men at the time when Yogananda went to America. And Dr. Lewis and he would wrestle sometimes. And I asked Dr. Lewis, who won? And Dr. Lewis said, well, I let him win. Yogananda had tremendous power. There was one time, one of the women at Mount Washington, a disciple of Yogananda's, her brother was very angry, and he decided he would show up, he would beat up Yogananda and boast to everybody, I beat up this charlatan. And he was coming up the stairs to beat him up, and Yogananda was sitting on his bed in the bedroom meditating when he saw this man coming. And when the man reached the doorway, Master said, I know why you're here. But as he said, I don't want to use force, but I warn you, don't cross that threshold. Go on, prophet, what can you do? So the man stepped across the threshold and he fell to the ground. And he said, I'm on fire. And he got up and he ran out of the house, ran down the stairs, ran out and was rolling around on the lawn outside. And Yogananda went outside and touched him. And he was cured of his pain, but he said, don't come near me. And he just asked his wife to get their things. They just ran away. But Yogananda had tremendous power, physical as well as divine. But we knew him as something much more than just a human being. I was amazed. I remember him saying to me one time, it was a very strange experience, and I don't think I'll tell it to you right now. But I remember him saying when he knew something that he had been asking me a question, and I said, well, don't you know? Because I had prayed to him, and the test that I was going through suddenly ended. And then he asked me questions about it. I said, well, were you there? Didn't you know? And he said, very casually, he said, when you're one with God, you are God. I didn't know what to say. Well, to Norman one time, another disciple, Norman wrote him a letter and just said that whenever I see you, I see the Divine Mother. Yogananda didn't, he was tremendously humbled. He didn't have any sense of ego. But when he read that, he didn't say anything about, oh, it's not true. It is. He just said, just sort of tapped him on the knee with his cane. He said, then behave accordingly. How did God create the universe? He didn't have anything to create it out of. He had to create it out of himself. You know, we can teach things now that we could not teach 200 years ago because nobody would have understood us. How can you say that this chair is not solid? How can you say that your body is not real? It seems completely real, and yet now science has proved to us that matter has no reality except as a vibration of energy. Matter is non-existent as matter. Everything is made of energy, and energy is only a manifestation of thoughts, and thoughts are only a manifestation of consciousness. Everything is his dream. You could not teach that teaching 200 years ago and make it stick. Nobody would know what you're talking about. When in a darker age, we are now out of Kali Yuga. I know that the tradition is that we are in it. Sri Yukteswar, my guru's guru, said that we are now in Dwapara Yuga from the year 1900. But then back in those days, they didn't have the understanding. You know, people had seen, for example, ships coming from a distance. And they didn't start as a small speck on the edge of the horizon and grow larger and larger and larger. You see them suddenly appearing in the mast and then more and more of the ship, and suddenly the whole ship would be there. They've seen that. I've seen it. I used to cross the Atlantic several times in my life. 9 times I had to cross from Romania, where I was born, to America, where my parents were born. And I would see this phenomenon, and I remarked on it. But people saw it before and didn't remark on it. It wasn't until the age reached the point where people could understand that this world is round, that phenomenon could be understandable. In the next age after this, which will come in another 2,200 years, the people will enter an age of a mental age, Treta Yuga, the third age. And in that age, people would know, in this age, they will demolish the delusion of space, and they'll go to other planets. They've already gone to the moon, sent missiles to the other planets, and so on. You'll find people traveling quite easily. The UFOs are not a dream. They've come from other planets. In this age, that delusion will be conquered. Then will come the delusion of time. And in Treta Yuga, people understand the delusion of time. And in Satya Yuga, which will come 3,600 years later, you will have people understanding everything is really only a dream of God. But you know the Bhrigu Sanghita, the Agastya readings, those were written in Treta Yuga. People knew that in this time certain people would come to that reading and get readings, and it was to give them a demonstration that these writings were given. I found some for myself there. It was quite amazing to learn. It said that my mother, I had brothers but no living sister possible, that my mother would have one miscarriage, but I had no living sister. And it spoke about the future in ways that turned out to be true, and many things came true. So in Treta Yuga, this is going to be a normal thing. Well, in God's creation, you are only his dream. Now that being the case, this ego of yours doesn't have any reality. It's only a little individual pinpoints of his consciousness that take like little waves on the ocean. Each one of us is just a bulge on the ocean. Each one of us is only a part of that infinite ocean of God's consciousness. Now your destiny, you have no other destiny. Your destiny is to know God and to become one with him. Heaven isn't enough. You've got to go far beyond that. A truly advanced person doesn't even bother about heaven. He's only thinking of oneness with God. That's what you should be seeking. I remember many years ago, I was a young man. I was trying to understand what life is all about. I didn't want to believe in God because God was such a, in the church has taught him in such a boring way. I thought, let's leave him out of it. And I was trying to find truth. And I was looking for truth in astronomy. I was looking for it in politics. I was looking for it in everything. And I finally reached the point where I understood that I'll never find truth if there isn't a God. Everything's a dead end. There has to be a God. And I remember taking a long walk out into the night near Charleston, California, Charleston, South Carolina. And I was saying to myself, if there's a God, what must he be? He can't be a judge up there waiting for me to make a mistake so he can clap me into hell. That's ridiculous. But what makes me ask this question? The fact that I'm conscious. And that means that he must be consciousness. And this was a great discovery for me. I'd never read Vedanta philosophy. I'd never read these things. And I thought, well, if he's consciousness, then my consciousness must be a part of his consciousness. And if that's the case, then the more open I am to his consciousness, the more I can become what I should be. And the more closed off I am from it, the less I have of fulfillment. And I decided there and then, that night, then my job in this life is to seek God. I was 21 years old. I remember coming home to my apartment. I was rooming with four other young men, and they were laughing at me for being so serious always and asking about things, so always trying to figure out what life is all about and so on. And I just thought, why should I bother with these yapping puppies? I just knew from then on I had to seek God. There was a time, though, when I thought, well, nobody in history has ever sought God. I didn't know anything about saints. I thought a saint was just a kindly person who patted children on the head and helped little old ladies across the street. I didn't know what a saint was. And I thought, am I going mad? And finally, I just reached the point where I thought, even if I go crazy, I have to seek God. And then God arranged everything for me. My parents, I didn't know anything about Indian philosophy. My parents would have been a great obstacle. But S.O., my father was a geologist for S.O., they sent my father to Egypt. The very day that I put my mother on the ship to go join him was the day I walked uptown New York and found Autobiography of a Yogi. And that was my introduction to India. And I took the next bus from New York to Los Angeles. You know, and I met my guru. The first words I said to him were, I want to be your disciple. I was 22 years old. That was 63 years ago. But I have never changed my mind. My whole life I have given to serving him and to making his teachings known. Well, his teachings are a wonderful thing. The first thing he mentioned, the first thing he taught, was that we must become one with God. It isn't just me. We all must find that. We'll never find our destiny. And you know, the wonderful thing is this great fear that people have that if they lose their egos, where are they? That's one of the big obstacles on the path, the fear of losing oneself. The thing is, Master said that every atom is dowered with individuality. And you will never, even when you give up your ego, you're a particular manifestation of God. And even when you merge in him, there will be that memory, which remembers having been Lisa Kaz or John Novak or whatever it might be, and will remember, I was that person. You will be one with the infinite, and that is your destiny. But you'll never lose anything. Jesus Christ said, seek the kingdom of God first, and all these things will be added unto you. All the things that you've considered so precious. You'll lose them all, but you'll find everything in God. But the one thing that you'll think, well, I can't keep my ego. You do keep your ego. You keep your individuality to that extent. In other words, there's nothing lost in finding God. You want money, you'll have all the universe of wealth, all the universe of pleasure, all the universe of power. God is Satchidananda. God is ever-existing, ever-conscious, and as my guru added the translation, ever-new bliss. And that ever-new aspect of God, which Shankaracharya didn't emphasize, Yogananda added that to it. It explains why God would even have created the universe in the first place. Why did he create it? Because it's the nature of perfect bliss to want to express itself. When you feel bliss, you just want to share it with everybody. And so God, they say in the Indian scriptures, God created the universe so that he might enjoy himself through many. And you think, well, gee, I don't know about the joy bit. When you're suffering, is he enjoying himself through you? No. But he's enjoying this marvelous drama. You know, if you read a novel and the person is born into a wealthy home and he's brought up in a good environment, gets a good education, because of his father's influence, gets a good job, marries the boss's daughter, rises into the firm, takes over the firm after the boss retires, inherits the boss's house, everything goes easy and perfect and no trouble. You think, what a boring book. Supposing, however, the same person had been born on the wrong side of the tracks, as we say in America, with no money, no opportunity for education. He gets a candle and studies his book by the candlelight, and with great efforts manages to educate himself to the point where he can get this good job. And because of his skill, he rises and he meets the boss's daughter. All the same things happen. At the end, you say, what a good story. I remember James Collar, the man of hamburger fame, said, I have such a longing for God. Why does it take so long to find him? And Master said, that's what makes it so sweet when he does come. So God will test you. God won't make it easy for you to find him. After all, think of the countless lives you've been turning away from him. He wants to be sure. I know my guru said, I asked my guru one time, are the people who are coming here into this world during this Dwapara Yuga going to be around in Satya Yuga? He said, oh no, there are many other planets to go to. If they came to the same planet, they would find out too soon. And you think, well, why shouldn't they find out as soon as possible? The thing is, God doesn't want you to find out. He wants you, by your own discrimination, to realize that you must find him and that without him nothing else can work. When you've reached that point, then he's happy to take you and just embrace you in his arms. But it doesn't come easily. Why did God create the universe? That was his nature. But you know, this dream, although it's a dream, still it's very real, isn't it? In a dream, if you hit your head against a dream wall, your dream head will hurt, won't it? And so the pains of this world are real to us, even though God knows that they're not real. Even though God knows that all the suffering in this world doesn't really exist except as a dream. But in your dream, it does work. Wake up from the dream. Benvenuto Cellini was a very famous sculptor in Italy, and he had troubles with the Pope. I think any religion that has a Pope is not a good religion. Something wrong somewhere. Anyway, the Pope wanted him to keep working without paying him, and Benvenuto Cellini said, I won't. The Pope threw him in a dungeon, and Cellini was in a dungeon with a damp mattress, rats running everywhere, water everywhere, not enough light to see by except to read by except 1 hour a day, and he read the Bible. And the rest of the time he had no one to talk to, so he talked to God. And finally he felt so much joy that he ended up saying that if you really want to know what joy is, arrange to be put in a dungeon with the damp mattress and rats and everything. He described all the same conditions, he said, and talk to God and you'll find that everything else, it's worth it to find that. And you will say that someday, when you wake up from this dream, you will find that there is not one saint who has ever found God who has ever said, "What a scam." They all say it was well worth it. It was a drama. It was a wonderful drama. And they will say, "Thank God for everything." So if you are suffering, if you feel the pains of this world and the betrayals and the hardships that people go through, remember, this is a world of duality. Nothing can be either plus or minus. Nothing can be either pleasant or unpleasant. There's always both sides. Duality, dvaita. And that will be a part of your life always. So that if you think that I'm going to become a success in life and reach the top of your success, remember, there's no up there. You have to come down again. From success, it's like a swing. You go back to failure, and then success, and then failure. And finally, it reaches a point of absolutely anguishing monotony. You think, I've had enough of this nonsense. Just constantly, like your horse wins, then the next horse, you lose it all. The next win, then you lose it all. And it's just not worth it. Finally, you think, I must know God. So, does Satan exist? Yes, Satan exists. But Satan is a part of God. He's a part of the duality. He's that part of creation that pushes everything outward. And in this world, Satan is very real. Don't go that way. You're, let's say, between two directions. God is on one side. Satan is this side. God is that side. I'm doing it from your point of view. Satan to the left, God to the right. But that's opposite for me. Never mind. And when you want to do anything in this world, there's often this voice that says, well, go this way, it'll give you more happiness, and you never succeed. Satan is a reality, and don't play with those things. You know, doctors will tell you that some people have those particular hormones or whatever it takes, that if they just take one drink, they become drunks. It's not hormones. It's the fact that you're an alcoholic in your last life. And that memory, as soon as you touch it, you fall into it again. Don't play with alcohol. Don't play with drugs. Don't play with delusion. It has its power. Stay away from it. But if you have to be in it, then indulge, but with detachment. And just keep your mind, withdraw your mind from it. And the more you do so, the more you will find that you can free yourself. But don't play around. Yogananda taught all these teachings in a completely new way. He helped us to understand, for example, the caste system. As he used to say, of all countries, every country has its own misery producing karma. And yet, the caste system originally was a very good thing. Now it is used to suppress people. It was intended to help them know how to rise. And so it's a matter of not being born a peasant or a merchant or something. Those are only symbols of that particular consciousness. A Shudra is somebody who lives, he can be a wealthy person, but if he lives only for his body and doesn't think about his mind and so on, he's a Shudra. Shudra is somebody who doesn't think creatively. A Shudra is somebody who doesn't use his brains. He uses his body. A Vaishya is not necessarily a merchant, but he's somebody who thinks, what's in it for me? He uses his intelligence to get what he can for himself. And a Kshatriya is not necessarily a soldier. A soldier is only a symbol of that. A soldier is one who is willing to give up his life even for his countrymen. And so a true Kshatriya, is somebody who thinks not of himself, but for helping other people. I'm a Kshatriya, because my whole life is given to helping people. And then you reach the point where giving them the best thing you can give people is not money or jobs or those things, but you reach the point of understanding the best thing to give them is God. And so you become a Brahmin. So that way I'm a Brahmin. But a true Brahmin is that. He's not somebody who's a priest necessarily. And then you go beyond the caste and become freed. But you have to go through those, and those are an upward thing. This is a wonderful system if you understand it right, because it says that if whatever you do, go toward that which will take you away from ego into freedom from self and realizing that you are a part of that infinite dream. Yogananda taught Patanjali in a very simple and very marvelous way. He explained the meaning of Patanjali. He said, Patanjali begins in his Yoga Sutras, he begins with, now we come to the teaching of yoga. Why that word now? It's very important. It means it's a part of the system of three philosophies, Shankhya, Yoga, Vedanta. Shankhya tells you why you should seek truth, why you won't find what you're looking for in this world. When you've understood that, then comes the question, how do we do it? That comes to yoga. And then Vedanta is really, you can be a true Vedantin only when you achieve the understanding that everything is Maya and you are one with the infinite. So Vedanta explains what that state of oneness is so that you also know what to aspire to. But yoga, here's the wonderful thing, that wonderful passage, the second stanza, yoga chitta vritti nirodha. Yoga is an neutralization of the vortices, vrittis, of feeling. Chitta means feeling, not lower consciousness and all those things. It's like this, that as my guru's guru explained it to him, that if you have an image in a mirror, the mind receives the image, but doesn't understand what that image is. And the intellect says, oh, that's a horse. Then the ahankar, the ego, comes in and says, oh, that's my horse. And then chitta comes in and says, oh, how happy I am to see my horse. That's when the delusion really takes you. When the Maharaja of Kashim Bazar was first approached by my guru for land, the Maharaja said, well, I've given you land in Dihika for your school, but Yogananda said, it's too malarial, I need something that is better. And the Maharaja said, well, aren't you all yogis? Yogananda said, well, a mother gave her son some food to eat and asked him immediately, are you feeling stronger? And the son said, how can I tell my mother, the food hasn't reached my stomach yet? And so he said, these children are just learning, but you don't see me with the malaria. So then the Maharaja said, all right, I understand your point. But I want to know if you really know the Shastras well enough to teach young children the Indian teachings. So he brought a bunch of pundits in, and Yogananda said, I could see them as if prepared for a theological bullfight. And he said, let's ask questions about one thing, something that is not in the scriptures, but that the scriptures say that mon, buddhi, ahankar, chitta all have their relative locations in the body. Can you tell me where those locations are? Well, there's nothing in any shastra that tells you where those locations are. So they didn't know. So Yogananda said, mon is here at the top of the head. Buddhi is here at the point between the eyebrows. That's when you intellectualize. When you try to understand things with your reason, you tend to knit your eyebrows. And he said, ahankar is here. This is why when people are proud, they draw their heads back. Like that. And then when you have feeling, as soon as you have an emotion, your hand goes here. It's because the feeling element in man is in the heart. In the heart region of the spine, the chakra, the anahat chakra behind the spine. Behind the heart. And so in that way, these aspects of Patanjali, chitta is here. When you've calmed your feeling element, when you no longer react to the world, this is why Kriya Yoga, one reason Kriya Yoga is so important, the breathing in the spine is in the breathing truly in the astral spine is in the astral body. It's in the spine. They don't have air there. They don't pump with lungs. But the energy comes up and down in the spine, in the ira and the pingala. And these are related to the positive and negative reaction. So that when you see, let's say, a beautiful sunset or somebody that you haven't seen for a long time and you're happy to see him, the energy rushes up and you automatically inhale. And when you feel unhappy about something, maybe you've lost somebody that is dear to you or whatever, you sigh. This is just a normal human reaction. So Kriya Yoga is not some strange science. It deals with your reality. But it says that your reaction to things outside, you'll never get rid of delusion if your mind is outside. So bring it here to your reactive process. And Kriya Yoga helps you to gain control over this reactive process. I met a sadhu who was 132 years old. I met him in Puri many years ago in 1959. And he said, you shouldn't enjoy anything. I thought, well, that's a very dry way. But I remembered my guru used to say, enjoy everything, but enjoy it with the joy of God. This is what you can do when you can control the energy in your spine. You don't have to renounce things, but you control your reactive process, and you know that everything depends on your reactions, plus and minus. Rejoicing to see a thing, repelling it because you don't like it. All of these have to be taken inward before the energy can enter the Sushumna and raise toward the Sahasrara. And the Kundalini comes up then. So all of these things are scientific, but they relate very much and very closely to our own regular state of consciousness. We all know that when we feel happy, we look up, we sit straight, a mouth curves upward. Everything seems in an upward mood to us. And when we feel down, we exhale, we look down. You never see somebody who is looking down saying, I feel so happy. I think of the Rodin sculpture, the thinker. I think he looks like he has more like a bellyache. But you can see that in yoga and in what we know of human nature as it is to us, we know that certain things are universal. Yoga teaches truths that are universal. And when you think deeply, you put your mind here automatically. We were one time in the Yogananda Desert Retreat in 29 Palms, and there was a dog next door who came over. We were having lunch out of doors, and the dog was wrinkling his eyebrows, and Yogananda said, look, he's so desirous, so concentrated on this food, his mind is at the spiritual eye. Well, you have to realize that yoga is a very simple science. It brings you back to your own realities, but it helps you to know what those realities are. Yogananda showed people that these deep teachings are universal. They're not some strange technique that some person on the Himalayas can understand what you're talking about. Idol worship. He explained that this is only worshiping ideals. It's not idol worship. Idol worship is when you worship money. Idol worship is what those Jews were doing in the desert in Sinai when they were worshiping the golden calf. That means money. When you worship sex or wine or anything instead of God, that's idol worship. But to worship Kali as an image of God, to worship Krishna as an image of God, this is not idol worship. It's ideal worship. Without an ideal, even Muslims who are so rabidly against forms of any kind, they still bow to that Kaaba in Mecca. You can't get away from some outwardness. You need to have something to focus your mind on. So Yogananda explained, all these teachings have their deep purpose in them. Everything is Om Tat Sat. Om, well, let's begin with Sat Tat Om. The Christian teaching is the Father, God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Ghost. Christians believe that the Son means that Jesus Christ was the Son of God. Well, so is Krishna. Jesus Christ is the only begotten Son of God, so is Krishna. Only begotten? How can two people be only the only begotten? The answer is perfectly simple. It wasn't the man who was that. He had attained that consciousness. So Sat is the infinite ocean of spirit. Om is when that spirit begins to manifest. It creates vibration. It vibrates some of its thoughts. And those thoughts, like waves on the ocean, rising up and down, create the manifestation that we think of as Maya. All the countless vibrations, we are vibration. Your body is vibration. Your thoughts are vibration. Everything is a vibration of God's consciousness. And Tat is that infinite one reflected in that, that the vibrations are not separate from spirit beyond vibration. Sat is Kutasa Chaitanya, that consciousness which is reflected in every atom. And to find when you think of Krishna, when you think of Jesus Christ, when you think of these great masters, they're not human beings. They're human beings too. But their reality is that they are one with that infinite consciousness. And that is how Yogananda could tell our thoughts from a distance, how Jesus could tell people's thoughts from afar, and so on. Well, one time, Master, because of that, he was able to perform amazing miracles. One time, Oliver, he told us, God doesn't perform these miracles for people ordinarily, but if they're very highly advanced, then he will. Mr. Black was the second most advanced disciple, Yogacharya Oliver. He lived in Detroit. And he was visiting Yogananda in Encinitas one time. And Yogacharya Oliver received word from Yogananda that he wanted to go out for a drive with him. And Yogacharya Oliver looked out the window and he saw that it was pouring rain, like the heaviest monsoon rain you've ever seen. It was just like that. He said, you couldn't see out the window. He said, how are we going to enjoy a car ride when we can't see out the window of the car? But he had faith in his guru, and so he said, all right, and he came out. Well, from where that piano is to the front door was about as close as his bedroom to the front door. And he left his bedroom. It was raining like cats and dogs. When he got to the front door, he went out the front door. The sky was blue. The ground was dry. The car was dry. It was as if it hadn't rained at all. And Yogananda looked at him with a small smile. He said, for you, Oliver. Well, to be able to change the dream like that, just in a moment, that takes a certain divine power. But he had that power. There's a lovely story, and it's sort of a replica of something that Jesus Christ did, too. One time in Encinitas, Yogananda had about 10 guests, and he asked one of the monks to go and get some carrot juice from the carrot juice plant that we had. And the man came back and said, well, it's only this much, and there were 10 guests. He couldn't give him that much carrot juice. Master said, bring it anyway. So he brought it in a little pitcher, and Master said, serve the guests. Well, the monk thought, well, this is absurd, but all right, he tried it. And he poured the first glass, filled it, filled the next glass, filled 10 glasses. It was still the same amount of water, of carrot juice, in the pitcher. But all the carrot juice he needed was there in their glasses. So he also brought people back to life. There was one time in Serampur, as they call it nowadays, outside Calcutta, where his guru's ashram was. And he passed the house where there was huge lamenting. It turned out to be the, a cousin of a friend of his. And he went inside people that they had just lost the head of the family. He had just died. Yogananda went in and he touched him, put his hand on him. Gradually, the man came back to life. And one time, Dr. Lewis said, well, would you have gone if Divine Mother hadn't told you to? Master said, no, I never do anything the Divine Mother doesn't tell you to tell me to. Well, one time in America, in Encinitas, there was a real estate agent, and his wife was dying. And the real estate agent came to Master and asked him to help him. And Master said, well, I can't go now. I don't feel, God doesn't tell me to go, but I will pray for her. Anyway, she died. And then the man phoned, and he said, it's too late now. And Yogananda said, well, now God tells me to go, so I went. And the house was full of grieving relatives and friends, and Yogananda just went into the bedroom where the woman was and sat down with her and put his hand on her heart and her point between the eyebrows. And finally she came back to life, and she said, I was so far away, but I've come back. Well, this power was something that he had. Norman and I, he did many miracles in his life. Norman and I, a fellow disciple and I, were plastering a garage by the entrance to Mount Washington Estates, which was Yogananda's headquarters. And the plaster was very old, and it kept setting up. I was mixing it. Norman was putting it on the building. And I had just finished pouring a new batch of plaster on the board. And when Yogananda drove up, and he was just going out, he stopped and he called to us. So we went down and we talked to him. And he held us for half an hour. And of course, we were happy to be with him, so we didn't worry about that. But in the back of our minds, we were thinking, well, now we're going to have to take a sledgehammer to that plaster. When we got back to the plaster, it was soft. It stayed soft the whole day. He didn't say anything. He never talked about his miracles, but somehow you found that in his presence, everything seemed to go right. One time, Joseph Carbone, he was a... his name is Brother Bimalananda later, but he was working on with Ananda Boy on plastering a building, and there was a tower with a ladder, and Joe Carbone was carrying the mud up, the plaster up on a big hod, and he had reached just the top of the ladder, and he almost reached it when the ladder began, because it was very steep. The ladder was positioned this way, that the hod began to pull backwards, and the ladder began to tip backwards, so that he would fall 20 feet to the ground, and almost certainly at least be very severely injured, maybe killed. He didn't know what to do. And so he just thought of Yogananda, who wasn't there. He thought of Yogananda and chanted, oh, as he did, the ladder came up and he finished his climb. But I know we had a foreman that we hired on the job there, and he said, I don't know how you yogis survive this place. He said, you're so in, you don't know the first thing about construction work. You've got to be careful. You can't just let a 2x4 fall to the ground without looking to see what's underneath you. I myself have seen a board fall at this angle that some one of you yogis dropped. And he had a lot of fun with us yogis. And he said there was somebody underneath that the thing was almost certain to fall over and hit him. I myself saw with my own eyes the board went this way. he finally became a devotee, and he went up to Mount Washington with a present, and he left it at Yogananda's door, and then he came back and he thought, oh, I forgot to put my name on it. And he was just kicking himself. Just then the phone rang, and Yogananda was on the other end. And Yogananda thanked him for the present. But it was, Jerry Torgerson was another case. Jerry Torgerson, Yogananda told us, don't hitchhike, it's not a good thing to do. But Jerry Torgerson one time was going to town, and he thought, well, he won't know. And so he accepted a ride. Well, these were three criminals. And they kept him in the car, and they drove out into the countryside instead of going downtown. And they wanted to involve him in a crime. And they stopped, and the two men sat in the car. Well, the one man sat in the car to make sure he didn't get out. The other two men went to a house where apparently there were some people waiting for him. And they knocked on the door, and they knocked on the back door. And finally, in a great concern, they came back and drove back and just pushed him off onto the highway and ran, flew, drove away. And Yogananda, when he saw Jerry the next Sunday at church, he said, "You must be careful. I told you not to hitchhike." I had to close all their ears so they wouldn't hear those people knocking. But, you know, they've diminished him in SRF. They don't seem to know, like Dr. Lewis saying, "Well, I let him win." They don't seem to know what a great man he was. I had that opportunity. I know one time there was a saint, and I was with Master out in the desert retreat, and somebody else, Daniel Boone, his name was, very improbable name, as Americans would say, but that was his name. Anyway, he asked Master about a saint that Master had seen in Encinitas, and Master said, "Well, I don't know which saint you're talking about." And Boone said, "Well, it was over on the bluff, overlooking the ocean there, Master." Master said, "Well, so many come here. How do I know which one you mean?" And I expressed surprise that so many saints came to him. He said, "Why be surprised? Wherever God is, there his saints come." Well, the editor of his writing, when they put that saying out, I submitted to them, they changed it to whoever a devotee of God is. Well, I'm a devotee of God, and I can't claim to have been pestered that way by saints all the time. He said, "Wherever God is, there his saints come." But they wanted to make him seem humble. They kept somehow diminishing his stature. But wherever, he was not just an ordinary saint. He was an avatar. As it says in the Bhagavad Gita, the fourth chapter, verses 7 and 8, "Whenever virtue declines and vice is in the ascendant, I incarnate myself on earth as an avatar. Appearing from age to age in visible form, I come to destroy evil and to reestablish virtue." Yogananda said, "I killed Yogananda long ago, many, many lifetimes ago." He used to say, "No one lives in this temple now but God." I have to say that in his presence, I always felt a certain awe. When I was with Ananda Moyi Ma years later, I felt as if she was my divine mother. But with Master, I was always said there was a certain awe there. I couldn't overcome it. He was so great. But his mission to the world, he came to change the Kali Yuga consciousness of matter and the to show, as science has shown, that material ways of looking at things are the wrong way. We've got to see that the reality is divine. And he came to teach a whole new, give us a whole new view of what life is all about, that this world really is not real. Well, he told us, therefore, that he was in a former incarnation, William the Conqueror. Well, for me, I was brought up in the English system, and I thought of William the Conqueror always as one of the great villains of history, and here I found he's my own guru. But apparently, William came to destroy evil, establish virtue. Okay. So William the Conqueror, you know, 430 years after the death of William the Conqueror, they exhumed his body and found that it was incorrupt. He was a great saint, but he had to perform a certain function. And so he could not be like the ordinary saint. He had to destroy evil. He had to instill good. And Yogananda in this world, in this life also, he had a world mission. He had to destroy wrong ways of thinking of things. And he had to put himself against many people. There were many Christians who were quite upset with him. He had many tests, but he survived them all. And he was filled with bliss always. He was, I think, the avatar of Dwapara Yuga. His mission, above all, was to bring souls to God. And through his disciples, he can continue to bring souls to God. It'll be his power that he can bring all souls to God, as many as come to him. I don't try to convert anybody, because I respect where they are, and I know there are many ways to God. But if you can find it in your hearts, if it feels right to you, then I know that this is one way. People ask me, how can I find a guru? Here is one true way. And I feel infinitely blessed to have been able to spend part of my life with him. God bless you.
Please take your seats. Swamiji is now going to probably sing a song or two for us, accompanied by music on the piano. I'd also like to invite the Ananda Choir.
Thank you.
By the stage. We'll have one last performance with them after these two songs. I request everyone to please switch off their cell phones once again. We'll be enjoying a few songs right now.
I've whispered your name. Through the pains and joys of life, my plea stays the same. Tempt me no longer, this world's not for me. I have known all its charms. Fold me now in your arms, make me free. Lifetimes have passed, I've called out to you through hope and despair. Lifetimes I've known, the goals that I sought awaited nowhere. Help me remember, there's one goal alone. All I am is yours. All I've done is yours, I'm your own. And now another one, which is called Love is a Magician. Love is all I know, sun rays on the snow of a winter long, in darkness without song. Oh, my heart's afire, burning all desire, only you remain. And life again. Too long I did stray, flung lifetimes away, imagined you did not care. I know now your smile was mine all the while, I listened and love was there. I can't breathe for love, all the stars above call to me, come home, life's waves all end in foam. Only love can heal all the pain I feel. What a fool was I to turn away. Love is all I know, sun rays on the snow, of a winter long, in darkness without song. Oh, my heart's afire, burning all desire, only you remain, and life again. Too long I did stray, flung lifetimes away, imagined you did not care. I know now your smile was mine all the while, I listened and love was there. I can't breathe for love, all the stars above call to me, come home, life's waves all end in foam. Only love can heal all the pain I feel. What a fool was I to turn away. Thank you, Izelia. Now the choir will come. One more song. This is a melody on all on one note. So happy we're all here.
Clouds that gather to bless.
Amen with us.